Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. You know how I know you're listening to the program is because you send me emails that tell me you're listening carefully to everything that you hear on the program, which I do appreciate. So shout out to you, Regina, in Newark, New Jersey. She made sure to send me a note. Neanderthals were human. They are classified as another species of human. Science has discovered that some humans today have Neanderthal genes. Actually, that last part, I've heard that from other people who have had their, 23andMe or whatever the genetic testing is, and they get back the quotient of, you know, their genetic makeup. And I have known some people who say that they are part Neanderthal. And in a couple of situations, I could see why. Anyway, that's true. Oh, that explains a lot. Part Neanderthal.
I've been called a troglodyte. I don't even know what that means.
You probably don't want to know if they called you that. So I turned to the trusty Wikipedia entry, and here's what it says. Neanderthals are an extinct species or subspecies of archaic humans who lived in Eurasia until about 40,000 years ago. The reasons for their extinction are disputed, but it says it's unclear when the line of Neanderthals split from that of modern humans. Studies have produced various intervals ranging from 315,000 years ago to more than 800,000 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. So my point earlier, Regina, was not to discuss the finer details of, you know, which of these various hominids are considered human, but rather to say to the point of if somebody asserts that the children of Adam and Eve, that they mated, so to speak, with a non-human species. And as you pointed out, and I'm glad you did, Neanderthals are considered human. So in a way, the Neanderthal part of it would be somewhat beside the point. But I got the impression that the priest was suggesting that these offspring of Adam and Eve mated with non-humans or subhumans, in which case the point I was making about bestiality would obtain. But clearly it does not obtain in the case of Neanderthals because, as you pointed out, they are indeed human. So thank you for that. But that's, as I say, how I know how closely you are listening. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Joel in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Patrick. Great to be on the show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're welcome.
I had a question. The caller who asked about her children getting married, she was wondering, if I remember correctly, she was wondering if they could get married sacramentally but not civilly for the sake of insurance. Was that right?
Yeah, that's the question she posed.
Okay. So I was just curious, not to, you know, far be it for me to go against your advice, but I was curious if it could be considered in the light of how much cohabitation the state seems to be comfortable with, if they were to just be merely, in the eyes of the state, cohabitators, but married sacramentally in the eyes of God, if that would be perhaps a more licit approach. Obviously, the diocese would need to give permission for whatever they decided to do.
I understand. So I don't interpret that as like you're going against my advice, and it wouldn't bother me even if you did, Joel, so please don't worry about that. My take on this is, and this is something that both a canon lawyer and a civil lawyer would have something to say about, and I'm neither, so I can't say anything authoritatively, but the sacramentality of a marriage is predicated upon that marriage being valid. So a valid marriage in the eyes of the church, all other things being equal, does not, strictly speaking, require the recognition of the state in order for there to be a valid marriage. So I think I referenced when in that earlier conversation, say in time of war or some terrible natural disaster, or let's say there was some devastation and there is no opportunity for people to get a marriage license, or they're not able to have the formality of the civil law recognizing their marriage. They can still be validly married, and if they're both baptized, then the marriage would be sacramental as well. But under the current circumstances here, and this is where a canon lawyer and or a civil lawyer could pronounce with more, you know, certitude on this issue, but it seems to me that de facto the state recognizes Catholic marriages as legitimate marriages in the eyes of the civil law. And so the agreement that the Catholic Church has with the civil authorities is that when a Catholic is married, so in other words, there's mutual cooperation. The state cooperates with the church and vice versa, so that because they both have a vested interest in the stability and the legality of marriage. And so the state trusts the church to marry people, and the church trusts the state to recognize these people as validly married. So the civil law and the canon law of the church are, you might say, kind of cooperating together on this institution of marriage. So what I don't think is the case is that the parish priest would say, sure, we'll marry you, but we're not going to turn in any paperwork to the state. We'll just keep it between ourselves. I don't think that would happen, is the point I was trying to make. I don't think that you could find a priest who would say, we'll do it on the hush-hush, and we won't tell the county because we don't want them to know, because we don't want you to lose your health insurance. I know situations like that do arise, but that trust that's built in this working relationship between the civil authorities and the church, I think we have to honor that. We have to abide by that. And as soon as you start having deception and trying to trick the system or game the system, that trust would go away, it seems to me.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. The de facto part you mentioned, that's kind of the way it is with that mutual cooperation and probably any cooperation with the church and state that we do have, we probably want to preserve. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense when you explain it.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm thinking about the laws as they have been in Mexico for about 100 years now, the anti-Catholic laws that have since abated. But for the longest time, they were really punitive against the Catholic Church, such that Catholic priests were legally forbidden from wearing clerical attire publicly. They could wear vestments and things in the confines of the church or the seminary or the rectory if they wanted to do so. But out in public, they were forbidden by law from doing so. So this also extended to the issue of marriage, and the Mexican government for the longest time, and I don't know if it's still currently this way now, but it certainly was until fairly recently, where the Mexican government did not recognize Catholic weddings as legal marriages, and the couple would have to get married in a service. They'd have to get married in front of, say, the justice of the peace or a magistrate first. And that was legally required from the government because it just didn't recognize the Catholic Church's status to marry people. And so what would happen is the couple would go to the justice of the peace and they'd get, quote unquote, married there in the eyes of the state. And then they'd go to the church and then they'd have their wedding. And thankfully, it's not like that here in the United States, but there are parts of the world like Mexico, at least used to be, where it was that way. So just a little example of how it doesn't always work hand in glove the way it does here. Anyway, thanks, Joel. Appreciate it. I want to read to you now this is a pastoral letter that was recently released from Bishop James Wall. He's the Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico. It has to do with Lent, and since we're in Lent, I want to share it with you. And this is called The Pillars of Lent. Here goes. I'm reading to you the words of Bishop James Wall. My dear sons and daughters in Christ, a blessed Lent to you all. As we continue in these 40 days, I wanted to write to you briefly to explain some of the meaning behind the three main pillars of this season: prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. At the heart of these practices, as with all things we do as Christians, is the glory of God. This is the primary reason we do everything we do in the church, to glorify God in the heavens, and so to bring peace and salvation to all mankind. These Lenten pillars do this in particular by helping us to detach from the things of this world so that we might attach and cling more fully to God. The sacred liturgy puts it this way: "For you have given your children a sacred time for the renewing and purifying of their hearts, that, freed from disordered affections, they may so deal with the things of this passing world as to hold rather to the things that eternally endure." And that's from the preface, the second preface for Lent. Prayer helps us to do this by devoting time to regular conversation with the Lord. This means we do not spend the time on other things, but rather in the quiet, intimate dialogue with the one who loves us the most. Fasting gives glory to God by helping us to deny our desires for pleasure and so stir up in our hearts a deep longing for God. We can think of Psalm 42 here. "As a deer longs for the flowing streams, so longs my soul for you, O God." Fasting also makes it possible for us in grace to restrain our faults, raise up our minds, and bestow both virtue and its rewards. That also is the preface it's the preface number 4 for Lent. In abstinence, a particular form of fasting from meat helps to humble our sinful pride, contribute to the feeding of the poor, and so help us imitate God and his kindness. Here we can see that fasting and abstinence allow us not only to draw closer to God ourselves, but to give of our own goods, food and money, to invite others to do the same. This is the third pillar of almsgiving. Each of these practices, therefore, is essential for living the Christian life, and he references Matthew chapter 6 there. And each year during the Lenten campaign of Christian service, the Collect for Ash Wednesday, we seek to renew ourselves in them, again for the glory of God and the salvation of souls. With this in mind, Bishop Wall says, it may be helpful to remember some of the church discipline regarding prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. Prayer has the most ample room for variation. Where, when, and how one prays can differ from person to person and from situation to situation. The important thing is that you pray regularly and consistently in ways that are biblically and traditionally sound. Similarly, almsgiving can take many forms. The important thing is that you do, in fact, give alms. This is supported especially by the consistent biblical command to support the poor, as well as the fifth precept of the church, which is, "You shall help to provide for the needs of the church." The church has a bit more regulation when it comes to fasting and abstinence and reminds us of the following, namely, that all Christians are bound by the law of God to do penance, that every day of Lent and every Friday of the year is a day of penance, that abstinence from meat is required for all Fridays of the year outside of Lent. Another penitential practice may be undertaken, but penance must still be done on Fridays. Do you get that? I'm going to pause here for a second. He's reminding the faithful that all Fridays during the year, not just during Lent, are to be days in which you abstain from eating meat. Now, during Lent, you have no option. You must abstain from meat on all Fridays during Lent. This is also true of Ash Wednesday. He makes the point, though, that outside of Lent, you can determine a different penance if you wish. The default is no meat on Friday throughout the whole year. This is every Friday throughout the whole year. And I know someone's going to say, but Patrick, what about if a solemnity falls on a... In that case, then the solemnity takes precedence. So you're not obliged to abstain from meat if a solemnity such as the Feast of St. Joseph or something like that were to fall on a Friday. But outside of that, all other Fridays during Lent, during the year rather, are for abstinence. So he continues, fasting and abstinence are required on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. He mentions the only solemnity that falls on a Friday. When this happens, you don't have to observe the usual day of penance. He says here in the Diocese of Gallup, this happens only when St. Joseph, March 19th, or the Annunciation, March 25th, falls on a Friday. And finally, he says, anyone 14 and older must follow the laws of abstinence, and those who are 18 to 59 years old must follow the laws of fasting. So I don't suppose it's necessary to overemphasize that, but I'd like to just add a little footnote to this, and that is that it's a good idea, even though by the law, your children below the age of 14 are not obliged to abstain from meat. I personally think it's a good idea to get them in the habit of doing this when they're younger and not say to them, well, you're 12, so sure, you can have a hamburger. I can't, but you can. I think it's good for children who are younger than that to begin the process of learning the spirit of these kinds of customs. So continuing with Bishop Wall's comments, he says, we can sum this up by saying that we ought always to seek to do penance, especially to strengthen our relationship with God and in reparation for our sins, but must especially renew ourselves through spiritual practices in these 40 days of Lent, so that more eagerly intent on prayer and on the works of charity and participating in the mysteries by which they have been reborn, we may be led to the fullness of grace that God bestows on his sons and daughters. He says in conclusion, as we move closer to the celebration of the sacred Paschal Triduum, I assure you of my daily prayers for your continued celebration of Lent and ask for your prayers on my behalf as well. I also give to each of you and your families my blessing. This is from Bishop James Sean Wall, the Bishop of Gallup, New Mexico. Beautifully written and very timely, to be sure. So we will get a link posted to this so you can check it out for yourself. And this would be a good thing no matter where you are, even if you're not privileged to be in the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico. Hey, good choice of music, Cyrus. Let's let this play for a second or two.
Where the grass is green to the prettiest gal you've ever seen. I'm gonna gallop, gallop, gallop to Gallup, New Mexico. Gonna jump in my saddle and away I go to Gallup, New Mexico.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. We don't have a lot of time left, though, so if you've been thinking about calling to be on the program, this would be the perfect time to call, 888-914-9149, and we'll do our very best to get you on the air so you can ask your question or get some advice or a second opinion, whatever you're in need of. I am here for you. 888-914-9145. Let's start over. 888-914-9145. Let's go to Gilbert in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Good morning, Gilbert.
Yeah, hi, Patrick. It's great to talk to you. Bishop Wall is a really good friend of mine. He's terrific.
Oh, yeah. You know, he's great.
I do have a question. Our governor that claims to be Catholic ran on a pro-abortion agenda in our last election in November. She also planned to codify abortion. And our legislature just passed a budget bill that included $10 million to build an abortion clinic in Dona Ana County. Dona Ana County borders Texas, so that's a good reason to put it there for her. She proposed this during her campaign. By signing this bill, is it considered a sin in the Catholic Church? That was my question.
Oh, yeah, it's a sin on stilts. Because to procure an abortion or to assist somebody in a formal material way to procure an abortion is a serious sin, absolutely. So to give $10 million to abortion clinics for the purpose of killing unborn babies, it's a grave sin on stilts.
I don't think it's even legal, but that's for another day,
Well, fair enough. But, you know, the terrible thing is that it's terrible enough as it is, but it's all the more terrible when you have Catholic folk, whether you're the president or the governor or the mayor or whatever, if you have some hand in perpetrating the atrocities such as abortion, Catholics of all people should know better and should not be doing this. And so when they do it, it makes it even more grievous, if you ask me.
That's very sad. Thank you, Patrick.
I agree. Yeah, elections have consequences, don't they? So
they do, And we prayed for the right outcome, but it didn't happen.
Well, every X number of years, you have another opportunity to try to rectify that problem. So using the vote as a way to...
That's why we never give up. Never give up. That's right. Never give up. Thank you.
I agree, Gilbert. Thank you. 888-914-9149. I have many emails to get to. This one comes in from Kip, listening in Easton, Pennsylvania, and shout out to you, Kip. I know, he says, there is a Bible verse that talks about how even a righteous man sins seven times a day. I may have the wording wrong, but I can't find it. This is a key passage that helps explain the need for purgatory. Can you help me? Well, sure. That is from Proverbs 24. Now, you'll find it written this way in some versions. I'm going to read to you from the Revised Standard Version. Other versions will have it worded somewhat differently. But it says in verse 15, so we're in Proverbs 24, verse 15, "Lie not in wait as a wicked man against the dwelling of the righteous. Do not violence to his home. For a righteous man falls seven times and rises again, but the wicked are overthrown by calamity." I think if that's the verse that you're looking for, I think that's the one that you had in mind. And as it pertains to purgatory, so, I mean, there's no mention of purgatory here, but we can draw an inference here that if even a righteous man falls seven times and rises again, that's referring to venial sin. So if he's committing mortal sins, he's obviously not righteous. He's unrighteous. So even those who are in the state of grace, we could infer from this passage, we still fall into some kind of sin on a regular basis. So whatever those venial sins might be, and the rising again has to do with being repentant for your sins. So I'm guessing, Kip, that that connection with purgatory that you're alluding to here would be that even if you do die in the state of grace, you have a plethora of venial sins that have caused effects on the soul, not to mention whatever mortal sins you may have committed along the way. And so those would need to be expiated, or the effects of those sin, rather, need to be expiated in purgatory. Not the penalty, as you know, because that can only be paid for by Jesus, by his death on the cross. But the effects of sin have to be eradicated so that we can see God face to face. Or as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the pure of heart, for they will see God. So if you're not entirely pure, you're not ready to see God face to face. Let's go to Michael now in Cedar Park, Texas. Good morning, Michael. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I've got a question. I saw on the most trusted of sources, the internet, a letter from Bishop Gregory Amon in New Orleans that was answering a question about alligator being fish or meat.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you had seen that or could just comment on the question of alligator fish or meat, and B, the validity of that letter.
Thank you. Well, I didn't see the letter. Archbishop Amon, of course, as the archbishop, he would have the competence to pronounce on that issue, whether or not it would be considered meat for the purposes of abstaining from meat during Lent. And my understanding, not from that letter, because I haven't seen it, but my understanding is that in general, alligator has been deemed to not be meat, not be flesh meat, for the purposes of Lent. I didn't see this letter, though. Did he say something other than that, or is that what he said?
That is what he said.
So where but it's I, come I, up
it
before.
Might have just been his generosity in answering, and, you know, in the way the letter was, or the question was asked, he was being generous in his answer. But you're saying it's a general position of the church.
Yeah, to the extent that the church, you know, has ever, I don't think the church has ever pronounced on alligators per se. But what I mean by that, Michael, is that when I have run into this question before, you know, historically, my understanding is that bishops have made the same ruling, that they don't consider alligator for the purposes of abstaining from meat. They would classify it in the same category as fish or shellfish, that it's permissible.
Well, that's a relief. So,
are you an alligator eater yourself?
Oh, of course. Isn't everybody?
I had it by accident. I was with a friend. We were at a restaurant in, of all places, we were in Georgetown, just outside of D.C. And he said, hey, I'm going to order something as an appetizer and see what you think. And I said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And he had ordered like popcorn alligator, something like that. And I ate it and I was fine with it. I thought it was chicken. And when he told me it was alligator, I thought, huh, well, that's probably the first time I've ever had it. And I think it's the last time I ever had it, too, because I've never ordered it at any restaurant where it's served.
Yeah, it's getting more common. And it does, in my experience, also always taste like chicken. But, you know, like chicken, not exactly. It's close enough, but it's exotic and it's kind of fun. And if you can, you know, take it as your sustenance, you know, while abstaining from meat, then all the better.
Yeah. And here's a thought, Michael. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Here's a thought that we should always remember. I have to do this too. We all do. And that is that as opposed to taking the approach on such matters as, let's say, abstaining from meat or fasting, rather than taking a minimalist approach, what's the least I have to do in order to squeak by the church's laws? You know, to what's the least amount that I've got to do to fit within the confines of the church's discipline on something like this? I think the spirit of the discipline, we have to remember, and I'll give you an example. So no meat on Fridays. All right, fair enough. You can technically not eat meat, but at the same time have a lavish seafood dinner. I know, because I've done it. And you have delicious fish, well-prepared, and maybe some shrimp. And you can say, well, I'm not eating meat. I'm fulfilling the church's requirement. So this, the letter of the law says no meat. The spirit of the law, which also pertains to no meat, I think we can't lose sight of that, and that is simplicity and humility. And what I mean by that in practical terms is, If you're going to abstain from meat on Friday, which is the church's law, I mean, you can substitute during, not during Lent you can't, but you can substitute for other Fridays throughout the year. You shouldn't be eating meat on Fridays anyway. But let's say you decide I'm going to give up television, or I'm going to give up drinking a glass of wine, or whatever it is that you might like to do. You have that option. But if you're going to go no meat on Friday as your penance, and you have a very nice, delicious, succulent fish dinner, maybe shrimp, what have you, it kind of defeats the purpose of the discipline in the first place. Because the purpose of the discipline is to suffer, to put it simply. And by suffering, you're entering into, as Bishop Wall talked about in his Pillars of Lent letter that I read to you a little while ago, you're entering into the sufferings of Jesus, and you're learning to master bodily appetites. So the lesson that I learned a long time ago, and I had probably had to learn it and relearn it several times over, is that if you're abstaining from meat on Friday, but yet you're living it up and having a really great meal with fish or, you know, shrimp, what have you, it, in the sense of the spirit, it kind of defeats the purpose. So as a rule of thumb, if this is helpful to you, personally, I find it helpful, is eat a simple meal. You can have fish if you want to. You don't have to. But if you have fish, or as Michael in Cedar Park, Texas, brought up the issue of alligator, if you want alligator, if you want shrimp or what have you, make it a simple meal. Simple and not elaborate. Because then, it seems to me anyway, you're not only fulfilling the letter of the law, but you're also fulfilling the spirit of the law. Enough said. 888-914-9149. How about Gabriella now in Bloomfield, New Jersey? Good morning, Gabriella.
Hi, Patrick. I just had a question about a relationship I'm in at the moment.
Okay.
So my boyfriend, he's married on paper with the state, because you guys were speaking of this earlier.
Yeah.
He's been separated with his wife for over 8 years now. He lives alone. I think that Jesus, he has a son named Patrick, actually, and I think that Jesus, because I had an abortion the same year that his son was born, I think Jesus gave him back to me.
Okay.
And I just wanted to know if I didn't want to be, like, breaking any sins. Like, I just wanted to make sure it was okay.
To be romantically involved with him? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he's not divorced, right?
He's legally separated.
Okay. Well, there's your answer. He's still married.
And okay.
So if he's still married, he's not eligible to be dating you or anyone else. I mean, I don't mean to be harsh. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm just telling you the reality of it. So okay. He's still married. Now, this would also get into the question of, you know, is he a Catholic? Is he baptized? Since he's not divorced, obviously he has not received a declaration of nullity. The church doesn't grant those unless there has been a divorce. So his marriage is presumed to be valid unless it's shown otherwise. So no, he's not free to date you. He's not free to kiss you. He's not free to hold your hand. He's not free to do any of those things because he's still married. And so if it should happen that they do get divorced and he does petition for a declaration of nullity and the church does grant that, and assuming that you yourself don't have a prior marriage or any other thing that would impede you from being eligible to get married, once that happened, if it ever did, then you would be free to get romantic or to date, let's put it that way. You'd be free to do that, but under the current circumstances, you're not.
Okay. Now, should I ask him? Should I? Because I didn't find out till later on, actually. Yeah. He didn't tell me right away.
Yeah, see, that's a red flag right there. if he, in a way, he kind of led you on, didn't he? Because he let you think he was a bachelor and free to date you. But if he didn't disclose that right up front, that's not a good sign, is it?
Okay, I guess I'm just going to have a conversation with them then.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And okay, you know, there is a path. There is a path forward if this is something he wants to pursue. Is he a Catholic?
Yes, he's like me. Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing in itself, obviously. So, if he wants to be serious about his love for Jesus, if he wants to be serious about following Jesus, then he needs to listen to the church and find out whether or not that first marriage was valid. And he can do that. He can find out. And in the meantime, the two of you would not date. You wouldn't be romantic. Doesn't mean you can't be friends, but you can't be romantic. And then wait and see what the church says. And if the church says, well, turns out that first marriage was valid, then you have your answer and you know that he's off limits. If the church says, well, it turns out that first marriage wasn't valid, well, then you're free to pursue a relationship with him.
Okay. All right, Patrick. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm sorry to have to tell you something maybe you didn't want to hear, but at least it's better to know the truth, right?
Right.
All right. Thanks, Gabriella. Hang in there. Chin up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Quick break, and we'll come right back right after this. This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, where you can boost your savings with their 14-month share certificate, earning a 4.14% annual percentage yield. Info at relevantradio.com/certificate.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, we are back, but not for much longer. Only have about 14 minutes to go. Let's go to Rosalinda now in Miami. Good morning, Rosalinda.
Hello. Hola. Buenos dias, Patrick.
Buenos dias.
I had a question. This past Sunday, yesterday, our masses were canceled because of a water main break. So there was no water in the area.
Okay.
So they had to cancel masses. I wanted to know, should I go to confession prior to receiving communion next Sunday?
So you didn't go to Mass on Sunday because there were no Masses available because of the water main break, right?
Yeah, there was no water, so toilets weren't flushing, no running water, people couldn't shower.
Yeah. Sounds unpleasant, especially if the weather was humid. Well, why would you need to go to confession regarding that? Because the reason I ask is that are you concerned that by missing Mass, you committed a sin?
Yes, because, because I didn't know if it was considered a sin because I missed Mass and didn't, fulfill my Sunday obligation.
Well, if the Mass wasn't made available, if the diocese canceled the Masses because of the water problem and there were no Masses at any of the parishes in the area, that's what I'm understanding. Do I understand it correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So you didn't commit a sin. It was beyond your control. Furthermore, if the bishop himself said this Sunday, due to these unavoidable circumstances, we won't be able to offer Mass, all the more reason why it's not your fault. It's not as though you willfully didn't go to Mass. You didn't have an opportunity to go. So there's no sin. Therefore, assuming you didn't commit any mortal sins other than, that in itself is not a sin in any case, but assuming you didn't have any mortal sins on your soul from before that, no, you don't need to go to confession to receive communion because you didn't sinfully miss Mass on Sunday. It was unavoidable.
Correct. All right. Yes. That's what I was thinking. I just wanted to clarify that.
No problem. Yeah. The only time you commit a sin is if you know you're supposed to do something and you willfully say, no, I'm not going to do that. Or you know you're not supposed to do something and you willfully, at least with sufficient reflection, and you have the freedom to say yes or no, and you say, yeah, I'm going to do that. That's when you cross the line into committing a sin. But if you're prevented from doing something like making your Sunday obligation due to illness or a hurricane or a water main break and the diocese cancels Masses in your area, those are things beyond your control. So you're excused from your Sunday obligation in that case.
Thank you. God bless
you. You're welcome. Thank you. You too. I would say stay warm and well-fed, but you probably have no difficulty staying warm in balmy Miami, Florida. I was there not that long ago, a few weeks ago. Lovely. Let's go to Genesis in Great Falls, Montana. Good morning, Genesis. Hello, Genesis. Ah, there you are. Okay.
Can you hear me? Okay, perfect. Yeah. I have a question regarding the traditional Latin Mass.
Okay.
During communion, either individuals who either aren't like predisposed to receive the Eucharist or maybe they're not in a state of grace. What is it that they do? Do they just sit back in the pew or can they somehow go up and receive a blessing?
Well, this is an interesting thing you're asking. So this contemporary trend, I'm trying to find the right word for it. It's not really a custom. I suppose it's becoming a custom, but this contemporary trend of people going forward to receive a blessing with their arms crossed over their chest. There's nothing wrong with the priest giving a blessing, obviously, but there are a couple of things to be aware of. First of all, this is not traditional, so you won't find that at a traditional Latin Mass typically. Maybe nowadays, because so many people do this now, it might be that in some traditional Latin Mass communities, you might see somebody doing that, but it's certainly not traditional in itself to go up just to get a blessing. So the best thing to do, it seems to me, would be just to stay in the pew if you're not going to receive Holy Communion. Now, there's a reason behind this that I think is worthy of consideration, and that is, Genesis, that people, I think, don't want, and understandably so, they don't want it to be noticeable if, let's say, a Catholic who is in the state of mortal sin. Just to give one example, because there could be different reasons, but let's just use that as a reason. If you're in the state of mortal sin, and it comes time for communion, and you don't get up and go, people are going to notice that. And so if you're married, and your husband and your kids get up and they go to communion, and you don't, your family's going to notice that. Even if you're not married, even if you're not necessarily with family, if somebody doesn't get up and go, people notice that. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that this trend toward people getting up and going forward to receive a blessing is because nobody's going to notice that. Nobody is going to see you, really, unless they're right up at the front of the church, they won't know whether or not you received Holy Communion. They just know that you got up and you went forward. So it's good if somebody knows that he is in the state of mortal sin and should not receive Holy Communion. It's good that he refrains from receiving Holy Communion. That's good, because it would be the sin of sacrilege if he were to do so in the state of serious sin. But what isn't so good, if you ask me, is it, how can I put this? It makes it less, there's less of a cost involved to you and to me, to sinners. There's less of a cost involved if you can evade detection. In other words, part of the human psychology, I think anyway, in being in the state of serious sin, is that you realize that there is a certain penalty that you pay if people notice that. Excuse me, I just bumped my microphone. If people notice that. So to use an example, in the early church, in the centuries immediately following the era of the apostles, it was customary that your penance would be public. Even if your confession for, you know, going to confession, even if what you said in the confessional was not made public, people could kind of figure out what you were guilty of by the kind of penance that you had to undergo. So typically, to give you an example, sins against the sixth and ninth commandment would typically involve a penance of you can't receive communion for a year or 3 years or 5 years, sometimes longer. And so you would just never go to communion because you weren't allowed to. That was part of your penance. Sometimes it would be that you had to sit in the very back of the church where those who were doing penance for really serious sins had to sit. So what I mean is, and this is probably way more of an answer than you thought I would give you, but it's interesting to consider, in the early years of the church, it was customary for your penance to be known publicly and then people could figure out what you did. And here's my point. That in itself was an incentive not to fall into mortal sin, because you knew that if you fell into mortal sin, there would be a certain price to pay in the form of people knowing that you had committed a mortal sin. It'd be pretty easy to figure out what was the sin that you committed. So we've lost that now. And not that I want to go back to that. I don't. But my point is that for people who go up and receive a blessing, it's minimizing any cost or any suffering that they might otherwise experience. And so in so doing, we have lost yet another incentive for not falling into mortal sin, because no one's going to notice. So it's a little thing, but I think it's a thing. I think it's worthy of our consideration that going forward to receive a blessing is not customary until recently. There's nothing wrong with it, but it has some disadvantages, if you ask me. That's one of them.
Okay.
I feel as though I have deluged you with an answer that you weren't expecting.
No, not quite, but definitely gives me much to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want anyone to feel as though they shouldn't seek blessings when they're available. But on the other hand, if, let's say, you know, we talked about mortal sin. That's one issue. How about a different issue? How about somebody's not Catholic? Now, we welcome them to come to Mass. We want them to come to Mass. We also want them to receive Jesus in the Holy Eucharist, but they can't unless they're Catholic. So the implicit dimension of that is become Catholic so that you can receive Holy Communion. So if non-Catholics are in the habit of coming to Mass and going forward and receiving Holy Communion, one of the downsides there is that there's an incentive to become Catholic has been removed, because even though they cannot receive the Holy Eucharist, they can still go up and get a blessing. So it's in their minds kind of, well, that's kind of nice. I can be satisfied with that. And it tends to undermine the urgency of the invitation from the Lord that they should receive his body and blood in the Holy Eucharist. And so if they can be content with going forward and receiving communion and they kind of blend in and they don't seem any different than anyone else, it has minimized, it has created, I think, a kind of disincentive for becoming Catholic so that you can receive the Holy Eucharist. Do you see what I mean? It's a bit subtle, but I think it is important.
Yes, I understand.
All right. I'm not lecturing you. I hope you don't feel like I'm lecturing you. I'm just, you raised such an important question.
Learning.
Yeah. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you for your patience. You're welcome. Thank you for your patience with my lengthy answer. We never really talk about that issue, so I'm glad you called Genesis. Thank you for that. Yeah, something to think about. If you are, you know, whoever you are, if you are in the habit of, let's say, living in mortal sin, and whatever the reason may be, maybe you have a certain sin that you tend to commit frequently. Maybe it's an habitual sin. Still a sin, still a mortal sin, and to the extent that you realize that and you know, well, I shouldn't go to communion, that's good that you're not going to communion. But here's where this question, this issue, this practice of going up to receive a blessing can become a real problem for you, and that is it can lull you into this sense of false security. Well, I'm going to Mass and I'm getting a blessing. Don't forget that that blessing is going to kind of bounce off you anyway if you're in the state of mortal sin. How is a blessing going to, in any substantive way, affect you if you're in mortal sin and you're okay with that and you stay there and you don't go to confession and you just remain in mortal sin day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year in some cases? What good is it doing you to go forward and receive a blessing? And so one of the subtle but real dangers is that you can become lulled into this false sense of security and you don't get out of the state of mortal sin. Just think for a minute about how dangerous and foolish you're being if you are in the state of mortal sin and you don't take steps immediately to go to confession. It's foolhardy. It's the epitome of stupidity. Forgive me for being so blunt, but this is the honest truth. If you're living habitually in the state of mortal sin, and you know you're in the state of mortal sin, and you don't take action by going to the divine physician who has the medicine to heal you of this grievous wound that you've inflicted on yourself, and that is the sacrament of reconciliation, the sacrament of confession, also known as the sacrament of penance. You're just fooling yourself because you don't know when you're going to die. You don't know if you're going to fall and hit your head, or any number of ways can take your life very quickly without any warning. And the worst possible thing you can do is to die in the state of mortal sin. Because guess what? If you die in the state of mortal sin and you haven't repented and you haven't done what the Lord asks you to do, which is to repent and be forgiven, you go to hell. There's no other way to put it. There's no nice way to put it. If you die in the state of mortal sin, game over, man, game over. And you didn't win. So for this reason, if for no other reason, don't fool yourself. The only one who loses is you. So go to confession. Get out of the state of mortal sin. And don't allow that little whispering voice to say, well, you can commit the sin today, and then always go to confession on Saturday. And by the way, today's Monday, so guess what? You can commit that sin as many times as you want between now and Saturday, because on Saturday you can go to confession. That's another sin, by the way, the sin of presumption. To assume or to presume on God's mercy, and you don't know when your life may end. So maybe this is the right time of the show, because we're about to go out in another 30 seconds or so. Maybe this is exactly the right time to bring this up to your attention. If you are in that situation, get out of the state of mortal sin as quickly as possible. Say a good act of contrition, be sorry for your sins, and then go to confession so that you don't have to ask for a blessing when you go up to communion. You're up there to receive the Lord in communion. That's what you should be doing. So if you get a blessing, that's great, but better yet, be in the state of grace so that you can receive Holy Communion. I'll leave it at that, but I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
Game over, man.